Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Cambridge Inside Out. I blew off the broadcast a couple of weeks ago, had too many things to do, but we're back here this time today, which is February 17th, 2026. So, anyway, a few things to sort of bring you up to speed on today, but I think maybe what I'll do is I'm just going to make a few little quick, personal reflections, as we say. This is that time of year where I often find myself doing that for a number of reasons. Probably the primary reason is that I actually first moved to Boston, Cambridge area on Valentine's Day, so February 14th in 1978. It's always easy for me to tell when people ask, well, when did you get here? I say, well, as soon as the roads were open from the blizzard of 1978. And that's ex exactly how it worked out. It was one of those sort of classic Casablanca scenes where you leave somebody at the bus station, and disappear, go move off to another city. But you don't need to hear all those details. But anyway, stayed for it with a friend over in Brookline for just a few days, found a roommate situation off of a roommate board at MIT actually, because I had applied to go to graduate school at MIT, but I hadn't really, that hadn't even been processed yet. So I came here. I was going to live here anyway, regardless. And only found out that I was actually accepted several months later. There's a story associated with that as well. But anyway, found a place here with housemates, and back then my rent it was. I mean, I think because I had a small room, I only paid $70 per month for rent, believe it or not, and eventually bought the building, but that was in 1985. Anyway, it's whenever Valentine's Day comes around, I always think about it because that's when I got here, so, and inevitably, when you think about specific things like that, you find yourself just thinking about the sort of the passage of time generally. It's kind of amazing to think that I've been here for 48 years now. Yeah, 48 years. Amazing. Really almost a half a century. And of course a lot has happened since then. A few other blizzards, but nothing perhaps like the blizzard of 78. Maybe there was the Snowmageddon back probably close to 10 years ago now, where it just snowed relentlessly for months and months and months. Parents have passed away decades and decades ago, but I'm still here, just plugging away. Kind of amazing to think that I've actually been doing Cambridge Civic Journal now since, what is that, 29 years, 28 years, 20 something, 8 years. So more than half the time I've been here. It's sort of kind of remarkable to really sort of think about that. And pardon my rambling a little bit about this here, but yesterday when I went for a walk, I often like to stop by Toscanini's, talk to my friend Gus, and who Gus Rancatori, who runs Toscanini's, and they were closed yesterday, but Gus was in there just taking care of business, and so we ended up spending time, and actually various people were just coming in. He was just giving out ice cream to people for because he's that kind of guy. But it was a woman asked me. I mean, you always meet the nicest, most friendly people coming in to Toscanini. So, there's a woman from Leonard Avenue who'd been around for a good long while was asking what I felt was some of the biggest differences between Cambridge when I got here and Cambridge today. And of course, I think almost everybody would probably say first, it's just a lot more expensive now than it was then. When I first came here, there was still, I think it's fair to say we were still sort of in the remnants of the 19, even though it was 1978, the whole 1960s-esque kind of mentality of people creating food co-ops, and there was free this, free that. Everything was a lot more kind of low to the ground, low stakes, as opposed to now where, I mean, sympathize with anybody who wants to open a business in Cambridge now, because it's like playing at the baccarat tables in Vegas. It's all high stakes gambling if you want to see if you can actually make something work here. But back then, things were pretty much lower to the ground. Actually, it occurs to me that when I first moved in with some housemates, they informed me that the household was a member of the Cambridge Food Co-op, so I would be therefore obliged to do volunteer work for the Cambridge Food Co-op, which was operating out of Central Square, which later became Harvest, and then it became sort of the art place down. It's closed, it's just empty, I think, right now. Down around where one of the marijuana places is, over near the number one bus stop in Central Square. But I remember going in there, and back then, the politics intertwined with all everything. It still does. And I remember it was like walking through the gauntlet. When you'd go in there, you'd have to sort of pass all the kind of hardcore Marxist literature, because I think it was just. So it's the kind of people who started food co-ops in those days, So I said, I just came here to, buy raisins or sunflower seeds. I didn't really come here for the politics. So I didn't really enjoy going there. And I think I did my volunteer stint just one time, and I don't think I ever did it again. But anyway, that all became kind of professionalized. And I guess it's maybe a little bit of a sample of the way things have always been. Even the food co-op became more of a business, and then got kind of incorporated and ended up in with labor relations problems with their workers. I think there's no more, they're long gone from Cambridge. The Cambridge Food Co-op, what was began as a Cambridge Food Co-op, I think ended up in Jamaica Plain in in some new identity of sorts. And I have no idea whether it's even surviving anymore. But this is this was the day of experimental schools and everything, and it's really different. I think perhaps maybe some of the more significant things that I miss from Cambridge back then versus Cambridge now is that any time of year, but certainly in the warm weather months, you could go up to Harvard Square, and the street musicians were just, they were great, and they were everywhere, and that's, I don't know if I'm. Is it fair to say that that's completely disappeared? Maybe it's just that I don't go up to Harvard Square in the evening so much anymore, but I don't really remember seeing street performers there in the last bunch of years, but it used to be everywhere. I think we probably have more street music playing in Central Square now than in Harvard Square. So that's a, I would love to see that come rolling back somehow, so let's recreate something in some new version of things. I think it would be kind of nice, to say the least. Anyway, so that's just sort of looking back a little bit here. Actually, one other thing that strikes me that this sort of borders on the political. I remember, a light went out across the street from me, street lamp, and it was dark, and we used to have some real ruffians used to gather at the old Longfellow School building, some of whom turned out to be very significant political players and nationally known comedians. But I didn't know that at the time, and nor did they. But when a street lamp went out, I said, well, okay, I might as well just call somebody, see if something will happen like that. And unlike my days in New York City, where if you called them because a street lamp got knocked out, it might take weeks before somebody responded or did anything about it, if at all. And back then, if you called up the Department of Public Works, they'd say, oh, yeah, we'll, or whatever department they referred you to, they'd say, oh, yeah, we'll send somebody out. And then within hours, it was repaired. Now, some things get repaired that way today. I think the city is responsive in some ways, through the C-Click Fix app, but it's much more spotty than it was back then. And I would say, and I've said this probably here before, I think back when you just called up and talked to an operator, an actual human being down at Public Works, things got done more quickly and better than they do now. We've sort of replaced responsiveness with bureaucracy. And that doesn't always translate into a better work product, in my opinion. But generally speaking, so many years being involved in civic affairs, serving on various city boards and whatever, I honestly feel that the city has become generally less responsive. Unless you're part of some political lobby, you know, who's kind of holding candidate endorsements and other, other blades over your head, so you the political people tend to be responsive more to political lobbies than they are to individuals these days. I don't know. That's good. Progress? Is that progress? I don't think that's progress. Anyway, just move on to something else here. I'm going to do this little Paul Harvey style today. Item two. There was just in the news over the last few days, there was some very significant passings of some rather, significant individuals. From the Cambridge, at the Cambridge level, it was Frederick Wiseman, who has been a documentarian of note. You know, really his own style of creating documentaries passed away, I believe, yesterday. He was living up, around either Avon Hill or Porter Square area for as long as I can remember, and still churning out films about, I remember Tittacott Follies, which had to do with dealing with mental institutions or institutions for the criminally insane, and some of the scandalous things that were sort of accepted as normal in those days. There was one on meat production, which was pretty alarming to actually see it, see what really happens in there. Kind of could easily turn you into a vegetarian, I would say. But even was doing one having to do with not far from where I grew up in New York, in Queens County. So I grew up in the Whitestone Flushing area, but Jackson Heights is not far from there, and he made a documentary about Jackson Heights. So. Which may or may not have been released. I remember I was reading it this morning. There's at least one production was not released, but hopefully will one day be re released. Another one was in the news this morning was Je Reverend Jesse Jackson. It was very, very significant, at least to me. I mean, I always thought he was sort of a really like a model of a sort of a good activism. You know, make good things happen. Always emphasized the positive. He was not negative in his rhetoric. He was very much more out of the mold of Martin Luther King in terms of empowerment and making people just feel better about themselves, honestly. You know, who can forget the the chant of "I am somebody," from Reverend Jackson. Yeah, it was great. And he was a presidential candidate, long shot candidate, of course, but I think his presence as a candidate back, I believe it would have been in the 1980s, was significant, And he certainly didn't embarrass himself. I think he was great. By the way, nor did he embarrass himself when he actually did a spot on Saturday Night Live reading Green Eggs and Ham, which was in classic Jesse Jackson style, So. And another person, sort of from more of the Hollywood end of things, that really kind of struck me was passing of Robert Duvall, who I think most of us remember. I think his very first role was his he appears at only at the very end of the movie To Kill a Mockingbird as Boo Radley, and the scene where he's discovered there is really just a one of the most touching scenes I think I've ever seen in any film anywhere. He was also in a great Twilight Zone episode during the fourth season when they did hour-long programs called Miniature. Where I just think he just added something to every role that he played. I thought he was particularly great. Now, getting just back here in the local level, sometimes you see these announcements as part of city council resolutions of people who passed away. But one person who I knew from Central Square, I think his daughter works still with the Central Square Business Improvement District, is Donnie Williams. So that that's people who he was actually going to go work do some work on my house at some point a couple of years ago. We came by to scope some things out. Another person was Bob Patterson. Bob worked in the Department of Public Works for ages, I think in the engineering division. And back when the days when I was involved in recycling and composting, and I spent seemed like I was going down the public works department. I was like the unpaid the ultimate unpaid employee of public works because I was doing so much volunteer work, and I would always see Bob there. So he was very much a fixture. And so he passed away very recently as well. So bon voyage to a very good man, all great people around. So now another thing very specific I wanted to do here, sort of like item three, said Paul Harvey style, was somebody, I forget who, it may have been Gus, said, asked me something about triple deckers and actually referred me to an article that appeared just 3 days ago in the Harvard Crimson, which was it was really quite interesting, actually. Let me just see if I can, if I have it queued up here, I'll actually bring it to you. So you know, it was about the triple decker, you know. So let me just sort of pop over there just to talk a little bit about it here, you know. So you know, it's like the young staffers of the Harvard Crimson discover the really one of the most distinctive features when I came here to live in Cambridge was the fact that there were triple deckers. You didn't see any triple deckers in New York. I mean, there were single family neighborhoods, there were row houses, but you never saw buildings with porches. Maybe you saw a balcony here and there, but you know, the triple decker and its front and back porches, you know, multifamily homes were, that was something new, and I kind of liked them from the start. And in fact, the place where I moved in for my very first apartment is right below where I am now. It was in the first floor of the building in which I now own. So I never moved. You know, I came here probably around Washington's birthday, you know, after, you know, staying with a friend for a few days, but then and then I've been here ever since. So anyway, it's an interesting story. You know, again, in the spirit of sort of looking back, it brings a lot of things back in memory. I remember when I was first a political candidate back in 1993. There was another candidate, nice guy named Tom Weed, and I was just happened to be on the front porch, second floor front porch of my triple decker. And he happened to be walking by, just doing some canvassing of sorts, and he looks up and he says, "Is this where you live?" And he says, "Ah, the triple decker. That's how the Irish took over Boston." You know? And you know, in some respects, he was quite right. You know, the triple decker allowed working class people, which included a lot of Irish and Italian people at the times, and others, plenty of others, the opportunity to have housing that could be affordable as long as you were willing to do some of the work, and you could afford to live in your floor, and you could rent affordably apartments in two other floors. So you were providing affordable housing for others as well as for yourself. I think in the age of condominiumization, that whole equation has been completely disrupted. You know, I guess a condo is more affordable than buying a whole building, but you know, the availability of affordable apartments in the via the triple decker is something that's now, you know, everything has become a commodity, right? So now, you know, you buy condos as investment properties as opposed to just a place to live, and things are kind of different. So anyway, it's interesting. There were sections in this Harvard Crimson article on, you know, in Somerville. I love the pictures because the second picture, actually, the color scheme reminded me of my own house, except that it's a mirror image. I think the layout on the one on the left is almost identical, maybe absolutely identical to the layout of mine. You know, so they very much were sort of cut from the same cloth. You know, there's a whole section here on Cambridge with some of the local political people quoted, and some of the professionals, and also in Boston. So anyway, I found it to be very interesting, you know, and kind of relevant. Of course, you know, when people find out that I own a triple decker, they go, "Oh, lucky you." And I say, "Well, yeah, it is lucky me. I mean, I bought this place here just to keep the roof over my head. It was never meant as an investment, though clearly it is, but you know, it was either that or it would, you know, somebody else would buy it and then I'd probably be out." So I said, "Well, the opportunity to buy it was made available to me, so I took it. I was pretty scary thing, actually, to sort of be going to, taking out a mortgage and doing all that stuff here. But the person from whom I bought the building, it really made it all happen for me, and I'm grateful to this day for him having done so. But for those who think, oh, it's great, you're wealthy, you own property, they don't understand the other side of owning property, which is worrying, late at night about whether a boiler on its last legs is out to go out, and then your tenants are going to be freezing. So you're afraid to actually go on a vacation because you're afraid that there's something's going to break down in the building. The fact that I mean, I think it was just a week ago, I had to be a plumber, in the late afternoon to deal with a bathroom sink in the upstairs apartment, and then 2 hours later, I'm a math professor. So you sort of have to be, everything. You got to, sweep out the stairwells, hire the electricians, have the we had to rewire the building. It's a 100-year-old building. You had to actually pay to rewire the building, replace all the windows. We've had other plumbing disasters where we had a foot of water in the basement. If you think it's all just fun and games and a wonderful investment where you can make a fortune, right? Well, think again. And the other thing is there really is something about landlord-tenant relations. I mean, it's very weird to become a landlord, after, but I had a very good landlord, so I've always tried to be a good landlord as well and keep everything affordable, which I've managed to somehow do through all these years. So, that nobody here is suffering financially for the privilege of living in this building. And try and keep things at least somewhat together, maybe not have everything up, gilded and with Gen Air appliances, but everything works pretty much, and we sort of keep things running okay. And we have to shovel the snow and do all the other things that any other property owner is obliged to do. So anyway, my whole point really is if you think it's just all, making money hand over fist because your property is worth many times what you paid for it, honestly, that doesn't really mean a whole lot if you have no intention of selling it. So it's still just a building and you're just a person in it. That's really all there is to it. So actually, one other aspect, though it's not particularly relevant for me, but about the triple decker, is that in many parts of the city and in Boston and Somerville and really elsewhere, multifamily homes not only serve as a place where one person can own and then rent to others. There are a lot of multi-generational situations with buildings where you have a person, a family, an older couple have their child's family living in the other apartment, or their cousins live in another apartment. So it actually can be a way in which whole families can actually stay and be able to afford to be in the place where they grew up. It's a, when people talk all about housing development nowadays and they want to just put up 30 unit buildings and whatever, there's no way a 30 unit building is going to be sort of like a mom and pop situation. It's ultimately going to be a, something where a real estate company is going to be ones who are either renting things out or else everything's just going to get condominiumized and then you just get to be part of a big condo association. So it's a completely different model for things. I often also think about something I heard from Dennis Carlone when he was on the city council, when he was talking about human scale neighborhoods and development. And I don't know if he explicitly said it this way, but once you go above about 3 stories, which is what a triple decker would peak off at, it starts to, the further above that you go, the less you can really say it's human scale. I like to think of it in really simple-minded terms, which is that it's human scale if the person who's on the front porch on the top floor can have a conversation with somebody down on the sidewalk below. Now, if you're going to go down to, what do they call that? Cambridge Crossing, they have 40-story buildings, or the building went down on Broadway. I think it's going to be the tallest building in this city, 400 feet or something like that. Ain't going to be too many conversations with somebody off the balcony on the top floor and the people down on the street. You're almost like you're just another little cog in a gigantic machine above some point here. So anyway, so I still have my little bit of a love letter to the scale of the triple decker. Maybe you can go a little bit bigger, four stories, which I guess now you could do in Cambridge. They did pass the multifamily zoning that would allow you to go to four stories without any burdens. Or you can go to six if you want to do all the inclusionary. But honestly, unless you're building a big building with more than 10 units anyway, I don't understand why anybody would ever want to take on that option and have to basically deal with the city. So it's not really your pro at some point it's no longer not really your entirely your property anymore, when in fact you're obligated, you have all these obligations with the city, just under the inclusionary zoning, which, by the way, not to dwell on it too much, but there was still that lawsuit from Patrick Barrett and forget the name of the entity that he sort of did it with him, where they're challenging the validity of inclusionary zoning, at least as it stands right now. And again, I've certainly spoken of this before, but once upon a time, the city back, I think in 1998, they passed inclusionary zoning, where it was sort of like they mandated that 15% of the units back then, it was based on units, had to be made available to the city, for so-called affordable housing. And but they gave you back a bonus via density, so that you can, for every one you gave to the city, you could build another unit, which you could actually do at market rates. So it was a good kind of quid pro quo, balanced out pretty well. For reasons I'll never understand, the city council decided to change things maybe 6, 7 years ago to make it a flat 20% requirement, which I thought, well, that's already getting above the point where it doesn't make sense economically, and they were giving you nothing back in return. And more recently, even the mechanism for doing that disappeared, because with the multifamily zoning, I know I'm getting into the weeds here, the whole idea about density and ground floor area, those terms became meaningless at that point. So anyway, we'll see where that goes. My understanding is that sometime maybe June or July this year, the so-called Nexus study will come back, or at least they'll initiate it. I hope they've already initiated it. It just seems like the city does sort of screw around with important things. I mean, they were supposed to have done this Nexus study several years ago, and they just went, oops, forgot, didn't do it, or we didn't want to do it because we didn't want to hear the results. So now they'll do it, and then there's already plenty of speculation. City councilors are sort of not hiding from the fact that they may have to take that difficult vote of reducing the percentage from 20% to something that's more fiscally appropriate. Could be 15, back to 15%, but then where's the density bonus, right? Or maybe they have to go lower, which is not, which then people will attack them, when they do an absolutely rational, sensible thing of adjusting the percentage to what would make sense. They will then get attacked by some of the housing activists who fundamentally don't believe in private ownership of housing at all anyway. If it was up to them, they would turn everything into fully decommodified social housing, where, a la Mamdani, Anyway, we'll see what happens. So maybe if they actually do some modification that will accommodate the litigants sufficiently, so that Cambridge will continue on with inclusionary zoning without any trouble. Or maybe ultimately, after the first round of failures in court, when it goes on appeal, it could rise as high as the Supreme Court, in which case, there's already some speculation that ideas about inclusionary zoning could just get thrown out as a regulatory taking, illegal, unconstitutional. That's a possibility. I think it's a bit of a long shot, but it's not out of the question, especially with the composition of the Supreme Court as it is today. We'll see. I mean, it's actually kind of a similar thing might happen if this rent control question goes on the ballot, because it's so onerous that it's almost an invitation to challenge. And then that could itself could sort of race its way up the courts and end up invalidating rent control laws elsewhere in the country. So careful what you ask for. Anyway, so those are just a few things.